Una, thank you very much. You're very welcome back to The Late Debate. Tonight we're discussing if Ireland needs a Sarah's Law. Sarah's Law operates in the UK and it was named after 8-year-old Sarah Payne, who was abducted and murdered by paedophile Roy Whiting 14 years ago. In this documentary made in 2009, the investigating officer Martin Tosh Underhill, along with Sarah's mother, described that difficult moment when he had to tell her that Whiting had had a history of child abduction but had been released early from prison.
Tosh and I had a very honest relationship. I had asked Tosh in very, very early days, please, please be honest, don't lie to me. Honesty is most definitely the best policy, don't you think?
Most difficult time I had with Sarah was the honesty over Roy Whiting. He was arrested on the Sunday, the day after Sarah went missing. It wasn't the fact Sarah had been arrested, it was the fact that this man had done it before. And we had to tell her. And there were a lot of tears and a lot of anger. And she actually said to me, I want to know exactly what he did. And that was awful.
That was a very difficult moment. It was horrible to hear, but I had to know the details. And had Martin lied to me at that point, that would have been the end of our relationship.
Sarah Payne. Well, in a week here, where a 30-year-old man was given two life sentences for the rapes of two little girls, we're debating tonight if parents should have the right to know if a sexual predator lives in their neighbourhood. With me in studio tonight, our independent TD Dennis Nocton, who has proposed such a bill as part of the government's Sexual Offences Bill. Also here, Dervil MacDonald, legal editor with the Irish Independent, Ellen O'Malley Dunlop, chief executive of the Dublin Rape Crisis Centre, and on the phone from London, we're joined by Richard Garside, who is director of the Centre for Crime and Justice. You're all very welcome to our programme. And Richard, I'll start with you. Could you just explain for our listeners here in Ireland how the legislation, Sarah's Law, as it's more commonly known, how it actually works there in the UK?
Oh, good evening. Certainly the original proposals that came out, particularly from a big campaign that the News of the World newspaper ran back in 2000. It's certainly not that. Back then, the proposal was that it should effectively be an open access register. So anybody could either just go in and find out details or in some cases possibly have it published on the internet so for all to see. The way that the system works in the UK, really, it's called this Child Sex Offender Disclosure Scheme. And effectively what it does is it allows parents or guardians of children to ask the police if a person who has contact with their child has a record of child sexual offences. And that's it. Now, the police can provide that information or not. There was a freedom of information request made late last year, and that found that in the 2 years of the operation, there'd been about 4,700 applications, of which there'd been 700 disclosures. To put that in the context of the population of Ireland, had you got a scheme running at the same time, you'd have had roughly 307 applications, maybe about 50, 55 disclosures. So kind of in the grander scheme of things, very small beer.
Okay. Does the offender have a say in whether or not the information is released, or do they have any rights under this?
Yes, they can. They can challenge the release of the information if they have, you know, if they, for example, have concerns about their safety or they have other reasons why they wouldn't want the information to be disclosed.
And do we know in the UK who has put in the request for information? Who has applied to know this information?
Not really. I mean, there was an initial pilot that was done, and there was some research. There's an evaluation of the pilots that were done at the time. It was fairly light on detail in terms of who'd actually applied. And this is true more recently. There isn't really, to my knowledge, any systematic collation of data on who is applying for this information and indeed who is receiving this information. And, you know, again, we've had about, you know, over 4,500 applications, only 700 disclosures. Certainly my concern would be that you've got probably quite a few people who are applying for information, who are just applying, they want to get the lowdown on just like neighbour or some maybe someone who just think is a bit weird. Possibly also, I suspect, you're getting people who are looking for information about the new partners of their ex-partners, if they're concerned that maybe they have children from that previous relationship. But I think the fact that there haven't actually been that many applications, does suggest to me that, there hasn't been this big demand amongst the British public for these proposals, and perhaps they're rather more thoughtful and intelligent than policymakers and perhaps tabloid newspapers often treat them.
And is it now on a UK-wide basis?
Well, that system operates across England and Wales. There are, across the United Kingdom as a whole, there are three criminal justice jurisdictions, England and Wales, Scotland and Northern Ireland. So it's a scheme that operates across England and Wales.
OK. Dennis Nocton here in Dublin. Dennis, as I say, you have proposed such a bill as part of the government's sexual offences bill, which is, I think, at committee stage at the moment. Why do you want a Sarah's Law here in Ireland?
The reason that I want a Sarah's Law here in Ireland is to ensure that parents have access to relevant and appropriate information, because the reality is parents are always the last to know. The local prison officer knows, the Gardaí know, the health service staff know, and usually the parents are the last ones to find out. And they should have and have primary responsibility in protecting their son or daughter. And that's why I think relevant and appropriate information should be given to them so that they can take measures to protect their own children.
And what is relevant and appropriate information?
Well, that will have to be determined by the inspector that will actually make the disclosure. We're not talking about providing information that isn't relevant. For example, you would have someone that's convicted of an offence against a minor, statutory rape. They could subsequently go on and marry that young girl. They may raise their own family together. They're not considered a high-risk offender. That information isn't relevant. It isn't appropriate. So that information would not be disclosed under our scheme. It would only be if you have a high-risk offender living in the community. Relevant information can be given to parents to say, look, you need to protect yourself against this particular individual. But I think it's not just the disclosure that's made. I think it's about changing the whole atmosphere in this country and encouraging people to come forward with concerns regarding suspicious activity that's happening in their community. Because the reality is that the vast majority of offences that take place against children don't take place in relation to a stranger. But they do take place. About 70% of them are people outside of the immediate family. There are people that have built up trust, either a distant relative or someone that has come into the community and built up trust, usually with the parents in the first place. And I think it is important that if someone has a concern in relation to that individual, that they can check them out. And I think Richard made a very important point, and that was that in the UK, of the 4,700 requests that were made, 4,000 of them came back that there wasn't a disclosure. So it also clears someone if there are suspicions or innuendos about an individual living in the community.
Dervil MacDonald, do you think this is a good proposal?
I'm not quite sure if it would ultimately be the most intelligent use of resources. I can see all sorts of potentially constitutional difficulties with it. Like, I mean, are we talking about providing information on known and convicted offenders? Or, you know, that phrase that that you've used, you know, encouraging people to come forward with suspicions and concerns. Like, I mean, what information would we be asking people to get out? Would it be soft information? Would it be kind of suspicions that prison officers and Gardaí or other people have? So I think there would need to be huge clarity around known and convicted offenders. And what do you do looking for? Because you're right, Dennis, when you say that the vast majority of children who are abused in Ireland and elsewhere are abused by their fathers, their uncles or a trusted adult. We rarely have the horror of what we saw earlier this week in relation to the rape of two young children and the conviction and the life sentences too handed down to that man. Would Sarah's Law have helped in that case? Absolutely not. There was no prior history with this guy. The court heard that a psychiatric review found not one scintilla of evidence or suggestion of paedophilia. Were the public protected? Could they have been protected from that man? Arguably not. And we saw this debate in Ireland around the potential constitutional issues. And we have to remember that the UK, unlike us, doesn't have a constitution. So what do we do with people's right to good name? What do we do with this information? And I just wonder, there are so many policy options that I would be advocating before this. Like, for example, You know, if we're trying to protect children and others from known and convicted abusers, we have to strengthen our post-release supervision. I think that if the government was deadly serious about dealing at a policy level with rape and sexual violence in general, but also in relation to children, we need an annual report every 3 to 5 years. And I know Ellen to my left would probably agree. Every 3 to 5 years, we need a repeat of the SAVI, the Sexual Assault and Violence in Ireland report. And I think that there are a whole load of measures. Look what we had in the context of the child neglect and the child death debate, and this, you know, the mandatory reporting and all of the difficulties that posed with, well, what would you have if this, all of this information is coming forward? And whether you like it or not, you know, people who may have suspicions around them, they may act weirdly, they may not act in a manner that we think is fit. Do they have rights not to have information disclosed about them? And I can just see specifically in an Irish constitutional, notwithstanding the very good intent of a law such as Sarah's Law, it's also, what do we do with that information once we get it? It's an inescapable fact that sex abusers, even violent ones, even ones that are repeat abusers, have to live somewhere. So what do we do when we get that information? In the UK, as I understand it, and subject to clarification from Richard, that only the person who seeks it and is granted it is entitled to use and rely on that information. Are we going to have a repeat of the News of the World style paediatricians being pursued? And even in the context of the recent case, when that man was initially brought before the courts in a local district court, there was huge public anger. You know, huge public anger that potentially itself, you know, swelled over into public order disorder. So I think that we have to look at really intelligent use of resources, especially in a context where the stranger danger still, thank God, is the exception rather than the rule.
Absolutely. And we'll debate a lot of what you were saying there in more detail a little bit later, Dervil. Ellen O'Malley Dunlop, what's your view on a Sarah's Law for here?
Well, I think it's good to have the debate and to have the conversation, but I do think I support what Dervil is saying. We do need to put our resources into education, because it's like we're talking about convicted sex offenders in relation to Sarah's Law. We know that only 1 in 10 report the crime. So there are so many more offenders in our communities. And I would be really for supporting programmes like, for example, the Phoenix programme that is operated in 1 in 4 at the moment, where you have sex offenders who themselves present for treatment. And that is a much better way of dealing with this type of person in our community.
But in principle, Ellen, do you support the parents' right to know if a convicted sex offender is living in their neighbourhood?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, that's very complex. As we heard from Richard, you know, some people are asking about people because they're nosy. It's nothing to do about child protection. And we also know that when sex offenders, like, for example, in the States, we know that Megan's Law, the effect of that was it drove an awful lot of sex offenders underground, and they began to link in with each other, and it became much more dangerous. So I think that I'd really like to have the debate, though. I think it's important for us to have the debate and to look at the layers of what it means. And I think when we, in the most recent case outside of court, we saw people who were extremely, you know, they were charged. And you don't want to have that type of thing. You don't want to have a mob type response. And I think we really do need to have risk assessment. We need to have pre-release assessment, post-release supervision. And I know that the Gardaí have the SORAM, which is the Sexual Offenders Risk Assessment Management teams, where they meet on a monthly basis with the prison service, with the Child and Family Agency, the HSC. These are new programs that have come into being, mm-hmm. and I think we really need to support those and ensure that they continue continue to meet, and that those sex offenders are managed in communities.
Okay, back to you, Richard, in London. How would you assess the success or otherwise of the legislation there as it has been operating over the last number of years? Has it been effective, or is it pointless?
Well, I mean, the short answer to that is we simply don't know. There's been no evaluation or assessment of the impact. So we don't know whether a single child has been prevented from being abused or murdered or otherwise victimised by a predatory paedophile, or indeed, as more than one of your contributors point out, far more likely to be a member of their own close family. The issue here is I think everybody on this panel and this discussion are agreed that we need to do what we can to protect children and to prevent the kind of absolutely ghastly case that you had recently in Ireland, and indeed the many other kind of abuses of children that happen on a daily basis in any society, and we need to be clear that they are legion and multiple. Now, the question really comes, what is the basis of a coherent response? And I have significant concerns about the notion that somehow the state should be involved in outsourcing child protection to concerned parents. If the state is aware of individuals living in the community who are known to be a potential threat to children, and they are not, for whatever reason, in prison, then the state has an obligation to do everything within its power to protect the local population. And this is particularly important because even if you have a disclosure system in place, then most parents will not use that. So the state does not abdicate its responsibility simply because some concerned citizens can find out information, and if they're aware of that information, that they can then act on it to keep their children away from that individual. And as one of your other contributors pointed out, even if the parent knows about that, then generally speaking, they are under strict agreement that they are not allowed to share that information with other people. The vast majority of those people who pose a threat to children are not known to the state, and so there is not a basis for disclosing that information. And that points to the far more important task, which is systemic, long-term strategies based around challenging unhealthy and dangerous attitudes towards child sexuality, challenging adults acting in an inappropriate manner, ensuring that professionals in a range of institutions, in schools, in social services, in education more broadly, in the health professions, are aware of possible signs and act promptly on it.
Absolutely.
That children themselves are encouraged to speak about their experiences and not fear ridicule or being told off. So there's lots of things that can be done.
But Richard, in relation to just to stay with the point, I suppose, about the system and the people, the mm-hmm. convicted sex offenders who are in the system. Mm. And you know as well as I do and as everyone that the system doesn't always work. I mean, we were talking earlier about Sarah Payne and Roy Whiting. He had been in the system. He was released early. A psychiatrist said he had a high risk of reoffending, and yet he went on to abduct and murder Sarah Payne. So the system doesn't always work. It doesn't always monitor properly.
Well, Sarah's Law, had it been operating in the United Kingdom at the time, would not have saved Sarah Payne. I mean, I think this is a really important point to bear in mind. Sarah and Michael Payne were visiting with their family, Sarah's parents, and the children went out for a walk. And it was an absolutely awful case. Had huge ramifications, both clearly, notably for that family, but more broadly. But Sarah's Law would not have stopped Sarah Payne being killed that day. If the issue here is systemic failure of public institutions properly to manage and regulate people who pose a risk to children, then something needs to be done about those institutions. You don't solve the problem by outsourcing it to concerned parents. Particularly because most parents, however concerned they are, and all parents want to protect their children, most parents won't use this service. Mm-hmm. So they're not protected by this service, and nor are their children.
Okay.
That is a case for the state to take meaningful action. And, it's actually the boring aspect of actually dealing with bureaucracies and making them work as effectively as possible, rather than adopting eye-catching initiatives which play well with the tabloids press, but in the grander scheme of things, are very, very insignificant in terms of addressing the problem.
Okay, let me let Dennis respond to that.
I don't know where to start. First of all, Richard wouldn't know, but the panel here would know this legislation is not just about Sarah's Law. It is dealing with some of the gaping loopholes that are in the so-called sex offenders register that we have here in this country that needs to be radically overhauled, because there are huge aspects to this. It's not just providing parents with information, but it is important that if there is passive information sitting on Garda files, that that should be actually used and used to assist in relation to protecting children.
But we need to. Passive information is disclosed against you, and it's not sustainable, Dennis.
I'll come back to that in one second. Just let me finish.
Who decides that?
Well, look, Derval, I'm one. There's three on the panel here who are arguing against me. So just let me deal with the points that have been put to me. So you have a problem, you have a significant problem with the register here in this country. We don't have an effective sex offenders register in this country. We don't have effective monitoring of sex offenders. That's the first thing. Secondly, we don't have a system of proper assessment of those sex offenders prior to release. And that would all have to happen in tandem with this particular piece of legislation.
But are those issues much more important than parents accessing information?
No, I think it's important that parents also have access to information. And Derval was asking the question, is it a case that we're going to disclose suspicions? No, we're not. But what we need to change in this country is change the attitude that where there are concerns and suspicions, that they need to be reported to the Gardaí. In relation to what information will be disclosed, it's only relevant and appropriate information. Yes, it's not just convictions. It's also about soft information. And that's already provided for in the Garda vetting bill. So if it's good enough, the information which is collected by the Gardaí as part of an investigation, if it's good enough to stop someone getting a job, surely it should be information that's good enough to protect a child from unsupervised access or an individual from unsupervised access to a child. But Richard made a point that there hasn't been any assessment in the UK. There was an assessment of the initial pilot, which showed that there was 7% disclosures made in relation to the register there. But what it did show was that in 27% of cases, referrals were made to the social services in the UK. And the British Home Office said that it formalised the process of accessing information. It provided increased intelligence to the police forces there, and it provided a better route to inform for the public to bring forward their particular inquiries. And the significant difference between what's in the UK and what's being proposed here is that someone, a parent that's coming forward looking for information, must give a reason for that. So they can't just ask about their neighbour next door. They have to give grounds as to why they're looking for that particular information.
Okay, Richard. That's the case with the system in that operates in England and Wales as well. Parents can't just turn up and say, can you give me the lowdown on my neighbour? They do have to give a very clear reason, and it has to be treated quite seriously by the police. It's not just a kind of a free-for-all in that sense.
I think it's important that that's clarified, because the impression was given earlier that, you know, it's a nosy neighbour.
And Richard, what do you say?
It can be a nosy neighbour. I mean, that's the point. But the nosy neighbour is probably one of the 4,000 who doesn't get the information, but needless to the time, they're wasting police time who have to process their application.
Derval, you wanted in.
Yeah, no, I just would have concerns, you know, passive information. Like, I mean, I'd love some clarity from Dennis's. Are we talking just releasing information about known and convicted abusers? Is it passive information about those known and convicted abusers? Or is it passive or soft information about people you think may be up to something? Because I could just imagine huge, huge difficulties. And some of the issues you identified, no effective register, no monitoring of sex offenders, no proper post-release supervision, they are in the kind of menu of options, arguably far, far more important than just having parents. Because I would imagine that independently in this country, if any parent or somebody had a concern about a citizen, about the protection of their children, they could go to the Gardaí in any event and make a formal or informal complaint and have their concerns addressed. But I think to conflate the issue of no proper post-release supervision or no effective monitoring with the issue of parents' right to know is a little bit unfair, because I think that, you know, there are so many things. When I look at the criminal justice system, and when you look at the various different reports on rape and sexual violence and violence against children, there are so many, from the very, very beginning when an incident occurs to reporting it, the massive dropout within the system, actually getting through the criminal justice system. And this is one of the issues at the very, very end. And I just think we have so many priorities in a country. Today, a massive report in Europe showing that one in three women in this country have been exposed to physical or sexual violence, probably many when they were younger, much higher in other countries. There's a whole range of policy options, and I think that to just fly a kite that, you know, we're going to open up access to parents, known and convicted abusers, the more likely
but
than not that will come into the
legislation
community.
Covers far more than that.
No, I know, but yeah, we're looking, know, I know we're looking at a range of options, but to,
no,
to
no,
hang
no,
it
but,
solely
but in fairness,
on this.
When I published the legislation, it's not just dealing with sex, with disclosure to parents. It's also dealing with some of the gaping loopholes that are there within the sex offenders register. Now, I'm one individual. I cannot draft the legislation that I would like to see in place. But when I spoke in the Dáil and your colleagues reported, I made it quite clear that these issues need to be addressed. Your own paper,
I'm not doubting your integrity on this issue.
Let me finish. Your own paper has consistently highlighted instances where parents or individuals have been slow to report issues to the Gardaí, where there have been incidents in County Louth, in Dublin, in Mayo, where it took days for parents to come forward or individuals to come forward regarding suspicious activity. That attitude needs to change. The Gardaí needs to get access to that information quickly so that they can address it quickly and ensure that if there is
an
individual...
that can happen in any event. That's education, Dennis.
Yeah, and this law will help to change that and change the attitude in relation to it. That's why we're introducing mandatory reporting in relation to children's first, is because we need to have the law in place, because people without the law haven't been prepared to come forward and disclose relevant information to the authorities up to now. So the law will actually support that disclosure.
Dennis, lest you think you're under attack or that I'm attacking your integrity on this, of course I'm not. I'm just saying, look at the priorities. If you were to change rape and sexual violence attitudes and everything in this country, I'm just not entirely convinced that this initiative on its own will do that. I think there are far more important issues.
And if, when you read the legislation, which I'm sure you have, you've seen that the issues in relation to the sex offenders register. The fact that Dermot Ahern back 5 years ago said that Ireland will become a safe haven for sex offenders if the loophole, the 7-day registration loophole, wasn't closed off. This legislation that I have published does that. It deals with some of the other problems in relation to the registration of sex offenders. There's far more aspects of it that need to be dealt with. And this legislation has now been incorporated into the new criminal justice bill that the minister is bringing forward that will deal with all of these issues. This is only one small part of it. But it's an important part that parents need to be given recognition in conjunction with dealing with the register, by providing the information on the register, by providing the Gardaí with the resources to monitor those people on the register, which isn't there at the moment.
And when you're looking at the European Commissioner going to be here for the next 30 years, I would wonder that when we're targeting our resources and prioritising, is this among this menu of options, would that be your number one? I know if it was for me, there would be other areas, the ones that you've identified, proper monitoring, you know, in relation to the registration, tidying up all of those. And I just think that in terms of a priority, that's what I'd be going for, rather than a tokenistic gesture to parents that you can go to the guards when
not,
you can go
it's
there
it's
in
about
any
an
event.
Attitude change in this country.
Well, attitudes change take a long time, and I think just this week we saw the consequences of attitudes change, where these children actually came forward and told what happened to them and were believed. And I think that has come about because we have programmes in place now in schools, Stay Safe programmes, and they are being delivered. Unfortunately, some of the programmes in the secondary system are not being delivered, but these children were in primary schools. Mm. And that was a huge change, because I remember when the Ryan report came out we had parents ringing us and the Murphy report, and the parents were distraught because their children had told them things that had happened to them and they hadn't believed them, and these children went on to become adults who became drug addicts or alcoholics, or some of them had already taken their lives. So I think, you know, we have seen the consequences of putting proper educational system or educational programs in place, and these children, it was a horrendous thing that happened to them, over 20 minutes. Mm-hmm. And I can't see how anything could have prevented what had happened to them, because this man He behaved like a monster to these two children, and he has got an appropriate sentence. And I think that is really good. And I think Justice Carney giving him two life sentences and not taking any mitigating factors into account, I think that really sent out a very powerful message to society. And those children were helped immediately. We have people in place who know how to work with children and help them to get over what has happened to them, and the parents as well. They need help and support, and the family and the community, mm-hmm. because this heinous crime just doesn't affect. I mean, of course, the children are the main victims, but also the community and the families are victims of this crime. And we have, as I say, we have programs. There's mm-hmm. the 1-800-77-88-88 24-hour helpline. Anybody whose own memory is triggered, and I'm sure we've had lots of calls from adults who never reported the crime and who had heinous crimes committed against them as children, and they hadn't reported. And what has happened to these children and their bravery has actually enabled adults to come forward and get the support and the help that's there.
I just feel that sometimes, and I've been covering the courts all of my professional career, and we've an unusual relationship with criminal justice in this country, because the crimes that affect people the most, which occur in the district courts and the circuit courts, are those that are reported the least. The crimes that affect people, thankfully, the least, such as murder, rape and manslaughter, which occur in the higher courts, affect a smaller amount of the population. But I think sometimes there's a risk of us trying to reform the law through the very narrow lens of very, very high profile trials without looking at the broader, much, much broader and bigger issues. So, for example, one thing that comes up in relation to bail, for example, and we know that the Sylvia Roach Kelly case, not a sexual offences case, but that is being her family are challenging why her killer was out on release for a very, very serious attempted kidnap and assault on a child at that time. And often sometimes we go, we need tougher bail laws, we need a sexual offences register, without realising that there are other problems in the system. One of the main reasons why people are released on bail is because people don't realise that when it comes to the Central Criminal Court, there could be a 2 or 3 year wait until you get your case. The other day, when the child rape case came before Judge Carney, there were 6 cases waiting to go on trial, one judge. And the judge is pleading with the barristers going, what are the equities here? What do I do? Which case goes first? So there are lots of problems within the criminal justice system that need to be addressed. One of the most heartening thing I have to say since I became a legal affairs journalist is this. There are more and more frequently sexual offences being tried, which is bad in one sense, but good in another, because it means more and more cases are coming through the system. And although we have a massive drop off or attrition rate, cases that fall out of the system, and I think Ellen would agree with me here, of those that do get in, we have quite significant sentencing for those people who are convicted, up to and including life sentences. They're fairly rare, but they're not unprecedented. And I've certainly seen a much, much kind of tougher sentencing regime coming through. So it's almost been a generational thing, going back to all of the harrowing reports that we have, and things are changing, and changing for good reason. And I think that's the thing that sometimes, and I think, and I don't know if Richard would agree, but I think the Sarah's Law in the UK was a reaction led by the News of the World against that. And I just don't know whether and time will tell whether it's the most appropriate response, but I just would hate to see us direct such few resources that we have into something when actually maybe it could be better directed
and
elsewhere.
Richard,
and that's my only
I mean, you met directly with the News of the World editors, didn't you, at the time, and to try and persuade them to call off this naming and shaming campaign?
Yeah, yes, I did. And I mean, what we actually did in the UK was we built up a bit of a coalition of organisations. So the police were involved in the coalition. Campaigners for victims were involved in the coalition. The NSPCC, which is one of the main children's charities, child protection charities in the UK, were involved in the coalition. And we all went and met with the News of the World and talked to them about the damage that their campaign was doing. And it did have an effect. I mean, it did. They stopped their name and shame campaign, as they were calling it, kind of very, very promptly, actually, after that meeting. And then a kind of a classic sort of a British sense of mucky compromise was found, where everyone agreed that it was important to protect children's rights, but actually what that meant in practice was kind of largely evaded and avoided. And then we some years later, we are where we are with that. Now, I think underlying this, you see, I think one of the really kind of uncomfortable truths that we kind of, I think sometimes some of this focus on things like Sarah's Law tends to kind of hide, is just the scale of the problem. So in the United Kingdom, the NSPCC published a report not long ago, which found that 1 in 20 of children and young people under the age of 18 said they'd experienced sexual abuse involving contact. Now, that's several million children. Speaking for myself, what that means is that the secondary school I went to, there were maybe 30 or 40 children who were in the school when I was at that school who were victims of sexual abuse. When I went to university, maybe 300 or 400 people in my year at university had been victims of some form of contact sexual abuse. Now, the vast majority of those cases, that would have been close family members. Things like a Sarah's Law is not going to do anything about that, but what we need here is a very long-term focus. If you want to look for examples of that, in the United States, there's an organization called Generation 5, which aims to end sexual abuse of children within five generations. Now, I think that's the kind of long-term thinking that we actually need to address this problem, because what we need to remember is that what you have here are cultures of abuse which perpetuate themselves through family structures and through broader society. And there is not going to be an easy answer to that, but it does require sustained work over many, many years, really, to resolve it. And, you know, I appreciate and I recognise that that all the panellists here, you know, want to see action and they want to protect children. That includes Dennis. I mean, I take very seriously that his primary focus here is trying to make Ireland safer for children. I don't actually think Sarah's Law is going to deliver that, but, you know, if he wants to do some work to encourage the agencies to work better to protect children from those offenders who are known to the agencies, and I would only applaud that. Most offenders are not known to the agencies, maybe 80-90% if Ireland's like the United Kingdom, you know. So just focusing on agencies, making sure they control offenders, you're going to miss most of those who are abusing children. And that's a very uncomfortable truth, which actually you really need to engage with if you're going to really start to solve this problem.
It's a fair point, Dennis, isn't it?
It is, and in fact, I'd say probably the figures are higher here, because we have an attitudinal problem to the whole issue of child abuse here in this country. That's why we're introducing mandatory reporting to actually change that attitude. And that's why I think we need something like Sarah's Law here to actually change the attitude in relation to the public, that encourage them and make sure that they come forward and can actually disclose information to the Gardaí, relevant information, so that the Gardaí can act on that. Not necessarily to make disclosures back to the parents, but it's important that we actually encourage people to come forward, because traditionally that hasn't happened in this country. And, you know, I know that the point is being made, look, that this is reactionary. Look, I represent the community, part of the community where this incident happened. Mm-hmm. I know the devastation this has caused firsthand. But this legislation that I published, which not only deals with Sarah's Laws, but Sarah's Law, but also, as I say, deals with some of the gaping loopholes within the current sex offenders register, was published 18 months ago. And this has been debated prior to this particular tragic incident. But I think what is important is that we need to radically reform our legislation in this country in relation to how we manage sex offenders. The Department of Justice published a report 6 years ago. One of the aspects, one small aspect of it, is to introduce a disclosure for parents. But there's a far broader aspect to it in relation to how we actually reform the sex offenders register. And I think it is imperative now that this is prioritised, that the legislation that we have at the moment, which is archaic, which the resources aren't going into at the moment, is reformed, and that we actually ensure that parents form part of that and not be isolated, as has been the case up to now.
Okay. Dennis, I think it would be impossible to disagree with you on the need to manage sex offenders and to support parents. One of the things that has really, really struck me, I don't know whether it's just in the last particular number of years, the amount of people, including friends, who have disclosed they've been sexually abused in childhood, in their early adulthood. It has broken my heart. It makes sense of a lot of things now, looking back. But I think if we really, really want to support parents and to support society at large, the father of the six-year-old in that case last Monday said, "We have been touched by evil." And I don't think he was just referring to himself and his family and the other family. I think he was referring, I think everyone in society was bereft. But I think if we really, really wanted to support parents and society, going back and, one, getting a hold of the problem And, you know, we routinely, you know, the CSO, we routinely monitor all aspects of our lives. We need to go back every 3 to 5 years and find out what is the true prevalence of sexual abuse. Because it's only when we know the true prevalence that we can start having full evidence-based policies, that we can go back into our schools. Like, I mean, I think the one of the holes that the Catholic Church has had over this is that there has of society in general is that we aren't able to discuss sex and sexuality. Children aren't empowered with the language they're learning in school programs, but parents aren't empowered to deal with this. The father of the 6-year-old got into the witness box just yards from the man who'd defiled his child, and he said it was like a bomb gone off in their ears when they heard. If we had that routine 3 to 5 year evidence, well, then we could look at all of the parts of the constituent parts of the system that aren't working, up to and including the management of the offenders. But if you look at the ratio of the amount of people that are convicted compared to those who are not, that's the real scary part for me.
And I really support what Derval's saying in terms of the research. SAVI, which was Sexual Abuse and Violence in Ireland, it was the most comprehensive research ever done.
10 years ago, was it?
12 years ago now. And we definitely need to have it repeated. From SAVI, we learned that 1 in 5 women had contact sexual abuse in childhood. 1 in 5. Mm. And 1 in 6 men. Mm. I mean, that is really scary.
And that's children.
That's children. That's not adults. That's children in our society. Now, we need, though, to have the comparative research now, the comparative longitudinal. We have lots of snapshots. You know, we have, like, the Union of Students of Ireland did a really good piece of research last year where we learned from them that the young people in university who talked about the type of sexual abuse that they were experiencing, they didn't know it was a crime. Mm-hmm. It was just unbelievable. But it is the only way we can properly ensure that we have the policies in place to combat this crime. And it is an attitudinal right across the board.
And is it the same in the UK, Richard? We're talking here about the Sexual Abuse and Violence in Ireland report from 12 years ago, the scale of it. And presumably it's very prevalent there as well. But does the response by the government and the authorities match the scale?
Certainly not. And there is a sort of a growing debate, I think, in the United Kingdom about this issue, and also about an allied, but I think, you know, equally and in many ways more important issue, well, it's an equally important issue of female genital mutilation, you know, and there are suggestions that the British government might itself be vulnerable to legal challenge on the grounds it hasn't done enough to protect girls from female genital mutilation, and arguably the same could apply to sexual abuse as well. So it's a real and pressing problem, and indeed, there's a report just published today looking at this at a European level. And again, finding very striking, I mean, quite staggering figures, really, about the scale of sexual abuse. Now, what you do seriously about that, I mean, it's one of these classic problems, the problem feels so big that it's very difficult to know where to start. And you kind of, to a degree, need to break it down both at kind of an institutional level, what kind of institutions can do something serious about this. And you also need to be realistic about the timescale. You know, we are not going to deliver a society where, you know, children can grow up without fear of sexual abuse for some years. I mean, that's the reality, even if we started now. But if we're going to start now, that's better than starting tomorrow, and it's better than starting next week.
But it does require
sustained work over many, many years to do this properly.
Richard, I think there was a case in the UK earlier this week of a child who sexually abused his own sister after being exposed to porn. You know, when you look back, it does sometimes feel so big. Where do you even begin? And it is about attitudes, and there's so many, many different factors. And I don't want Dennis in any way to think that I was attacking him, because the proposals that you're putting forward are so important. But I just wonder, is the focus just on one particular area? And I think we do, like, the management of offenders does need to be looked at and overhauled. But I just, when I break the system down, you know, from when they get released, bringing it back to when they're convicted, bringing it back to the huge part, why so many cases fall into the system, bringing it back to the Gardaí or for Richard, the police, you know, why is it that so many victims don't move beyond report stage? Why do many victims not even get to report stage? Why does the DPP decide not to proceed with any cases? You know, there are so many constituent factors, and I just think that if we focus too much on the end game, that perhaps we'll just miss out on a lot that's happening, you know, much beforehand.
Just let Richard come back in. Sorry, Ellen.
I mean, I think an important point here is, you know, that the criminal justice process is largely designed, I mean, you say, you know, it's built up over many, many centuries, but it's largely designed by men to manage men. But actually, it has all those kinds of male assumptions built into it, which are often very prejudicial to other people, notably children and women, getting justice through that system. Now, you know, at one level, you therefore need to kind of take the whole system apart and rebuild it on a different grounds. But there are some inherent barriers here around evidential grounds. I mean, what do you do about a situation? We've had this, in, you know, in the United Kingdom recently with some of these historical abuse cases involving celebrities in some cases. What do you do in a situation where you have someone who's saying 30 years ago, this man in this witness box abused me, and there's no evidence to support the case apart from this person claiming that they did and the defendant saying, no, I didn't. You know, and it's actually, I mean, I think, you know, you need a wisdom of Solomon in some ways to resolve those things. So we're not going to resolve the pain and anguish that people experience through the criminal justice process alone, though it's clearly very important that it acts in a proper and a prompt manner when it comes across cases and allegations and deals with them appropriately and deals with the victims and with the suspects appropriately in a prompt manner. We're only going to deal with this if we engage in a long-term preventative strategy to stop these cases happening, because the other uncomfortable truth is a lot of people who abuse children were themselves abused. And whilst that's not an excuse for the abuse, it's certainly part of an explanation. And we need to tackle those cycles of abuse and traumatise victims who then themselves traumatise other victims. This is a very, very difficult process, but it needs to be done over many years and in a sustained manner.
I think also that it's in terms of the criminal justice system, we have seen the reporting rates going up, actually. And I think we have to give some credit to the Gardaí because they have engaged in training and in learning about the effects of sexual abuse, so that victims do feel more confident reporting to the Gardaí, but that doesn't go right across the criminal justice system. I think barristers, solicitors and the judiciary need to have appropriate input into education programmes so that they appreciate the effects of this crime on the individuals, so that they can stay the criminal justice system. I think we need to have the DPP give reasons when she decides not to put a case forward, because that's terribly important in terms of the healing process for the individual involved. But I think also that SORM that I referred to earlier, that the Sex Offenders Risk Assessment Management, you know, that needs to be built on again more and more. And it's a really good start. And there are national SORMs and there are local SORMs. And I think we need to invest more in those.
Dennis.
Yeah, look, the reality is that 70% of, based on the Rape Crisis Network report in October, they said 70% of those that are involved in sexual offences against a child are outside a close family member. They're someone that is known to the family, but outside of the immediate family. Only 5% of cases ended up with convictions, half of those in relation to children. So we're talking about a huge cohort out there that are people that have had abused a child and will probably go on to abuse again. And I think it is important that we change the attitude in this country and we encourage people and I believe incentivise people to actually go forward to the Gardaí and provide information. There's another important point here, and that is that we've had, I believe sadly, on quite a number of occasions, women, and mainly women, who have waived their anonymity because they want to make sure that the perpetrator is known and that when they're released from prison, that they're known to the community that they go into. By introducing my legislation, it will ensure that people can get access to that information without the victim having to waive their anonymity at the time of sentencing. So I think it is, I believe, important that we use, and Dervla is right and Ellen is right, we need research. But when we have information available to us, I believe it needs to be used. I think we need to overhaul our legislation here in relation to the monitoring of sex offenders. And Richard is right, you have to start somewhere. And there are many things wrong with the existing system, right from the time that people report a case. But we have to start somewhere. And I believe that this legislation is coming before the Dáil now. It's a reforming piece of legislation. It's comprehensive in relation to dealing with offenders. Mm-hmm. And I think that information to parents needs to form part of that new law.
Durville.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure whether, you know, encouraging parents to notify and disclose and giving parents information is naturally, you know, the flip side of the same coin. Again, I'll just go back to what I said earlier. You know, there is a risk that you you know, because you cannot legislate away the need to deal with the long term strategies that Richard's been talking about. And I would just be concerned that what we will get is just not quite a knee jerk reaction, but, you know, legislation that, because this radio debate has shown, we're focusing in on one tiny little aspect of the law, which I don't think is actually the main priority. I think that parents can and do go to Gardaí if they have legitimate concerns. But often when it comes to children, and I'm not quite familiar with the RCNI research in relation to the 70%, but the vast majority of child abusers, parents don't know until their children disclose. And no amount of going to the Gardaí, look, I mean, they're not going to go if it's your husband's brother and ask about it, you know, if you don't know over a long period of time. So I think that, and I think it ties in with Richard, look, I mean, I know when they were looking to roll this out to England and Wales, one of the questions and the concerns that the children's agencies over there, including the NSPCC, was to have ongoing effective monitoring of it to really to assess its efficacy. Because if it is only a small amount of, you know, people using it. So I know sometimes we can go into things with the best of intentions, but they may not be the best solution. And that's the only thing that I would just kind of just, you know, stand back and see, you know, where are going to the best resources be? Because I do think that aspects of this law that is proposed could pose difficulties constitutionally for those people who are not known and convicted, who can, in some circumstances, be identified. But I would hate to be a person against whom a cloud of suspicion is hanging over and there's absolutely no justification, and a local inspector can go and on a basis where your rights maybe aren't fully protected, go and share that information in a country of Ireland, which is no greater than Birmingham or greater Manchester. You know, I just think that there needs to be extra risks. And again, we just have that extra consideration, the fact that we have a constitution that protects the right to good name.
And Richard, is there a real fear of vigilantism associated with this legislation?
Well, I mean, I certainly do have fears. I mean, there was a notorious case a couple of years ago where an Iranian refugee was disabled Iranian refugee was killed by locals because people had alleged that he was a paedophile. You know, and of course he wasn't. And it was kind of in some ways a modern parable for our time. I think, you know, one of the discussions here is about this notion of parents' rights. Now, you know, for what it's worth, I don't actually think parents have a right to information that public institutions hold about other individuals. I think what they have is a right to expect those public institutions use that information in an appropriate manner to protect them if need be. Now, the issue that comes from that is if we go down the route of just assuming that parents have rights and it's their responsibility to do something about it, then over time you erode trust in public institutions, because the implication is, look, you can't really trust that public institution to look after your children, so we'll give you the information to do it instead. And I think that's quite a dangerous slippery slope.
Dennis.
Well, look, the reality is that the institutions here in this state have failed us and failed us dismally.
Well, so reform the institutions. Yeah,
that's what we're trying to do, is to reform the institutions.
Well, that's good.
But we also need to change the attitude in this country where people are not coming forward with information, suspicions to the Gardaí. And we have had it time and again, reports and papers regarding incidents in Louth and Dublin and Mayo where, you know, there was attempted abductions and yet it took days before they actually reported to the Gardaí. That sort of thing should not be happening in this country. And we need to radically overhaul the attitude to issues such as this, and we need to radically overhaul our laws in relation to the management of sex offenders in this country.
But how would giving parents the right to know if someone lives in their area, how would that improve that situation
because
of reporting?
You see, changing the law does make a difference because it changes the attitude. There's quite a number of women's groups in this country want to see the law changed in relation to prostitution, because they believe that it will change the attitude in relation to prostitution in this country. The introduction of mandatory reporting, that's the basis for it as well. And the reason for it is that by putting that law in place, it acts as an incentive for people to go to the Gardaí and to express whatever concerns they have regarding an individual. Now, as Richard has pointed out, in the vast majority of cases in the UK, there isn't a disclosure made. And I don't believe it's going to be any different here in this country. But it's providing the Gardaí with information regarding suspicious activity of an individual, and it allows the Gardaí to carry out further investigations into that and see, you know, if there is justification to those suspicions, if there's something else going on in relation to that particular individual. Because the reality is, the vast majority of these cases never come to the attention of the Gardaí. The victims don't come forward and report them. But actually, by proactively looking at this, identifying individuals, carrying out investigations, hopefully we can protect children in the first instance.
So wouldn't the argument then be that if you're a concerned parent and there's an individual in your area who you feel is acting in an inappropriate manner, going to the police and saying, look, I'm not happy about what's happening. Could you investigate it, please? I'm not sure how as a concerned parent, knowing that my neighbour, yes, indeed, does have some kind of suspicion in the past, particularly helps me, apart from just making me more worried. I still want the police to do something about it. Moreover, I can't tell my neighbours. So it's not like, you know, what happens then if I see one of my neighbour's children talking to that person? Do I go over and say, oh, you better go and talk to the police about this person? I can't tell you anything.
But I have a mandatory obligation to report.
I think it just puts people in a very, very difficult position. Just at a practical level of operationalising it.
But you see, Richard, here's the problem. You're underestimating the importance of the first step in that, and that is the parent going to the Gardaí in this case and expressing concerns regarding an individual. And that
is
not...
Maybe we just disagree about what the first step is.
Yeah, well, and that, I believe, is not happening enough in this country. There have been plenty of examples of that, and we need to deal with these issues at a very early stage.
I'm just not convinced that law will change that, because parents, as it presently stands, have an independent right to go and Gardaí and raise concerns about someone and can have confidence in a Gardaí investigation if it comes back and says, no, you've nothing to be concerned about, or perhaps you do. Like, I'm just not convinced that this one small law in a whole category of laws that you're hoping to introduce will suddenly change, you know, bring about a sea change of attitudes. And it's that, and that's the only, you know, I just would have reservations about it in circumstances where who's going to monitor and implement this scheme? Who's going to decide what is relevant and knowledgeable? I could imagine the four courts would be full of cases of people bringing, you know, look, I mean, how do you root out malice? How do you root out all of those things? I just don't know if it is the most appropriate piece of legislation at this time when there are so many competing demands on the government to deal with all aspects of rape and sexual violence.
All right. Well, look, we're out of time. Thank you all very much indeed for joining in our discussion tonight. Thanks to Richard Garsay joining us tonight from London, to Ellen O'Malley Dunlop, Dervil MacDonald and Dennis Nocton here in the studio in Dublin. We're back at the usual time, 10 o'clock tomorrow night. Join us then if you can. Till then, from me and from all the team, good night.